This is Morning Edition from NPR News. Good morning. I'm Renee Montaigne. Struggling U.S. automakers have gotten most of the attention lately, but the collapse of the market for new cars has hit Toyota, too. Its American sales fell by more than 30% in June, and for the third month in a row, Ford sold more vehicles here than Toyota did. The decline is just one of the many issues facing the world's largest automaker. NPR's Wendy Kaufman reports.
The challenges facing Toyota require strong leadership, and the company has a new man at the top. He's Akio Toyoda, the grandson of the automaker's founder. At 53, he's young by Japanese standards, and his appointment, sooner than expected, is intended to convey that the company plans to be aggressive in addressing its problems. So far, Toyota's redesigned Prius Hybrid is selling well, both in Japan and in the United States.
This vehicle has smart key.
Toyota officials Kevin Coford and Jeremy Schoen hand me the keys to a bright red 2010 Prius.
What you do is walk up to the vehicle to unlock it. You touch the two little lines on the door handle there. Beeps twice. Unlocks it. There you can go ahead and get in.
When the hybrid first entered the U.S. market a decade ago, its appeal was somewhat limited. But today, it's deliberately marketed as a mainstream American car that gets 50 miles to the gallon.
To start it, just touch it, and you'll see the ready light come on, and that means we are ready to rock and roll.
After a test drive, I can report that it's roomier, more powerful, and has more gadgets than the earlier models. Over the past few years, Toyota's overall sales in the U.S. have grown dramatically, from about 9% of the market a decade ago to nearly 17% last year. But Jeff Schuster, a senior forecaster at J.D. Power, notes that Toyota is not immune to the industry's overall woes. The number of cars sold here is down sharply, and the automaker's share of the U.S. market actually declined in recent months.
Toyota is not used to dealing with sales declines. This is new territory. I think that's why we're seeing the management changes that have taken place, but that's why we're seeing talk of refocusing.
The growth and expansion mentality that served Toyota well may no longer be the right approach for the American market.
I think it's going to be, let's slow things down. Let's put the brakes on a little bit.
Right now, there's excess production capacity here. What's more, and this is a company-wide problem, quality has suffered a bit on some models. And quality is something Toyota is known for. John Paul McDuffie, an auto industry expert at the University of Pennsylvania's Wharton School, says Toyota's product development cycle had been sped up and was moving too fast.
Toyota has been a leader in reducing the lead time for new vehicles. It was 4 years, it was 3 years, it was 2 years, it was rumored to be down to 18 months. In some ways, that's an advantage. You can bring new models to market more quickly. But if you get quality problems from it, it's probably not worth it.
Toyota, he continues, recently announced it will build more physical prototypes during the development process and not rely so heavily on digital models.
You know, I think they do take quality issue and generally the improvement process very seriously. And the J.D. Power quality numbers, which just came out, Toyota was back on top.
The survey ranks initial vehicle quality. Toyota and its sister brand Lexus had more segment awards than any other automaker. But Toyota has yet to gain back the automatic recommended rating it used to get from Consumer Reports. Toyota, of course, faces other hurdles. Running a big global company of any kind is tough. Competition from Korean car makers and others is getting stiffer. And as the number one automaker, everyone is gunning for you. In this ad, two neighbors are outside watering. A Prius is parked in one driveway, a VW Jetta in the other.
Hey, Max. New car, huh?
Yeah, the Jetta TDI clean diesel.
I got a hybrid, so, you know.
A TDI set a Guinness World Record 58 miles per gallon.
58 miles per gallon?
But this baby hauls. It's like...
What's your hybrid sound like?
But Toyota may well have the last laugh. Experts believe the Japanese giant, with its fuel-efficient technology, new leadership team, and loyal customers, remains well-positioned to stay on top of the automotive world. Wendy Kaufman, NPR News, Seattle.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Robert Siegel.
And I'm Melissa Block. So-called sin taxes are always popular in a recession, and this latest downturn is no different. At least 11 states are raising cigarette taxes to help balance their budgets, and others are considering doing the same, as NPR's Debbie Elliott reports.
Higher tobacco taxes have been part of the budget debate in nearly half the states this year, and in some surprising places. Even tobacco-growing Kentucky raised its cigarette levy. Mississippi did so twice.
I need the light 100s in the box and the menthol in the box.
Smoker Mark Stuflick picked up two cartons of generic cigarettes at Lakeland Tobacco in Flowood, Mississippi, and asked owner Anil Verma about the state's latest tax hike.
Going up again?
Yeah.
Good grief. Definitely going to make me quit.
That's what public health groups want to hear. They advocate higher tobacco taxes as a way to discourage smoking. Mississippi raised its cigarette tax 50 cents per pack in May and then added another 25 cents a pack this month on cheaper cigarettes made by companies that were not part of the state's settlement of a lawsuit against big tobacco firms. Before that, Mississippi had one of the lowest cigarette taxes in the country at 18 cents a pack. Democratic State Representative Cecil Brown of Jackson is on the Mississippi Legislature's Joint Budget Committee.
The Medicaid budget in our state is just about to eat us alive. And a substantial number of people who are on Medicaid are smokers. If people are going to choose to smoke, it's voluntary activity, and they're costing the other taxpayers in the state money, then they should contribute to the cost.
After years of opposing and vetoing higher cigarette taxes, Republican Governor Haley Barbour, a former tobacco lobbyist, relented in a year when the state was facing a $400 million shortfall.
He suddenly somehow seen the light.
Peter Fisher is vice president for state issues at the Campaign for Tobacco-Free Kids. The group has successfully lobbied for higher taxes in Mississippi and elsewhere this year. Florida raised its cigarette tax by a dollar a pack. Rhode Island, too, bringing the total tax there to $3.46 per pack, the highest in the country. Cigarette tax hikes are still on the table in several other states, including California, Georgia, and Utah. Fisher says as state lawmakers grapple with record budget shortfalls, tobacco is a convenient target.
States are looking for a proven way to raise revenue and also a politically viable way to raise revenue. And cigarette taxes across the board are supported by huge majorities of voters.
On average, less than 20% of Americans smoke, so most people aren't affected by cigarette taxes. Frank Lester with Reynolds American Tobacco Company calls it poor policy to single out smokers.
Tobacco companies don't pay excise taxes. People do. Working Americans pay excise taxes. I mean, clearly those who can least afford additional taxes, particularly during a recession, are being asked to foot the bill for state legislatures.
Tobacco generated about $19 billion in revenue for states last year, but the Congressional Budget Office warns all that money won't be there in the future. Cigarette use has been on the decline over the last 50 years, and higher prices tend to drive down sales even more. Tack this new round of state taxes to the 62-cent federal cigarette tax hike in April, and it's a double whammy for smokers like Robert Smith of Goshen Springs, Mississippi.
They've taxed enough, goodness. When are they going to quit? Enough's enough.
Is it? Public health advocates argue that when tobacco revenues drop, states can always bump up the taxes even more. Debbie Elliott, NPR News.
From NPR News, it's All Things Considered. I'm Robert Siegel.
And I'm Melissa Block. In most states, welfare caseloads have been going up over the past year, but not in every state. In some places hardest hit by the recession, caseloads are actually going down. NPR's Pam Fessler explains.
It's taken a while to kick in, but welfare caseloads are rising in many areas as the effects of the recession sink in. Florida, for example, has 14% more cases than it did a year ago. Don Winstead, deputy secretary of the state's Department of Children and Families, says that's as it should be.
In a declining economy, you would expect the caseload to go up, and that's certainly what we're seeing. And in the areas of the state where the economy has been hit hardest, Southwest Florida and the Tampa Bay area are places where you've seen the highest increases in the caseloads.
But in Michigan, it's a very different story. That state, with the nation's highest unemployment rate, has been seeing a declining welfare caseload. Michigan's Director of Adult and Family Services, Barbara Anders, thinks one reason is that people are leaving the state. Another is that many who've stayed behind are getting unemployment benefits.
right now you can get up to 79 weeks of unemployment. And if you're receiving unemployment, you're usually receiving too much in benefits to make you eligible for cash assistance from our area.
She says there was a small increase in welfare cases in April, and she expects that turnaround to continue as unemployment insurance runs out. But advocates for the poor think that the real reason for the decline, here and elsewhere, is that changes made to welfare in 1996 to get people off the rolls and into jobs are now hurting those in need.
What we see so far is a safety net that is weaker and slower than we would have hoped.
Liz Schott of the Liberal Center on Budget and Policy Priorities in Washington says only a few states have seen big increases in their rolls. Utah, with 29%, is the biggest. Most of the increases have been modest. And according to the National Conference of State Legislatures, not only Michigan, but Texas, Georgia, Indiana, Alaska, Montana, New Jersey, and Nebraska have had their caseloads decline. Schott thinks one reason is that poor people have decided to seek other options, such as help from family and friends.
And some of that is because cash assistance has been made such an unattractive program to receive that families may be choosing to not get on, or they may be trying to get on and not succeeding.
I really didn't know what to do at that time. I lost everything. I had nothing to tell my landlord.
Rakia Mitchell of Flint, Michigan, found out in March that she was temporarily dropped from the state's cash assistance program, which she relied upon for herself and three children. Michigan has strict sanctions for those who don't comply with work or other requirements. Mitchell was told she hadn't submitted school attendance records, but she says a caseworker said she didn't have to.
They just railroad you, basically, and they put you in this category with everybody else. You know, and I wasn't the only person that happened to in that month. You know, it was three other girls in that room with me. And every last one of us come out of there crying, wondering, what am I going to do?
Advocates for the poor say the state also requires welfare applicants to participate in weeks of job search and training activities before they can get any aid. And that's a big problem for families with no money for transportation and child care. Barbara Anders of Adult and Family Services admits the state's strict, but says people are only dropped as a last resort. And she says it's unfair to look at welfare numbers alone.
I think we're still the safety net. I think we're still providing for our vulnerable families, because helping them is not just the cash assistance. It's the whole picture. It's the cash assistance. It's the food assistance. It's the medical assistance.
And here as elsewhere, the use of programs such as food stamps, a lot easier to get than welfare, has gone through the roof. Pam Fessler, NPR News.
Still, as Toyota struggles, one of its Asian rivals, Hyundai, is on a roll. Once the butt of jokes, the Korean carmaker is racking up awards and taking a bigger share of the American auto market in the middle of a deep recession. NPR's Frank Langfitt explains.
In the early 1990s, Hyundai's image was so bad, the brand served as an insult in a Hollywood movie. The film was Glengarry Glen Ross, David Mamet's tale of a down-and-out real estate office. Alec Baldwin played a highly paid corporate heavy. Here he is humiliating one of the agents he's come to fire.
You drove a Hyundai to get here tonight. I drove an $80,000 BMW.
He doesn't stop there.
You see this watch?
Yeah.
That watch costs more than your car.
Fast forward to last January. The scene is Detroit, the North American International Auto Show.
And the winner of the 2009 North American Car of the Year Award is Hyundai Genesis.
Hyundai won the award with its first luxury car, the Genesis. The automaker followed with a Super Bowl ad that played on its underdog status. Actors playing executives at BMW and Lexus yell at their subordinates about Hyundai's improbable win.
Hyundai!
Win one little award, and suddenly everyone gets your name right.
When Hyundai first came to the U.S., though, the name was synonymous with poor quality. Hyundai introduced the XL, a small sedan, in 1986. But within a few years, the seat fabric was fraying, and bodies were rusting out. John Wilkonowicz follows the car business for IHS Global Insight, the financial analysis firm.
Reliability and durability. It couldn't have been worse. It was one step ahead of a Yugo.
Hyundai became a punchline on late-night talk shows. Sales slid accordingly. The company spent the 1990s focusing on quality, and Wilkonowicz says it paid off.
All along, they have tried to model themselves after the best, which is Toyota. And they have been working on a plan of continuous improvement. And today, they're among the best.
But convincing consumers of that was another matter. By 1998, U.S. sales were headed for their lowest level ever, about 90,000. That year, Finbar O'Neill, an attorney, took over the American operation.
In September of 1998, we were on the precipice of oblivion, really. We had to make a decision as to whether or not we could profitably continue in North America.
Hyundai bet on itself. The company offered a 10-year, 100,000-mile warranty. The warranty essentially insured owners against most quality problems. Most analysts now consider it a pivotal marketing move. Hyundai also worked to improve exterior design and aimed to become the target of car companies. Finbar O'Neill, now president of J.D. Power, explains.
To me, Target represented value delivered in a stylish way that you could be proud to own. You didn't have to explain that you shopped at Target because it was a smart buy.
This year, Hyundai has ridden its blend of quality and low prices through the recession. Like all car companies, its sales have fallen, but not as far as others. So Hyundai actually increased its overall share of the market. John Krafcik runs Hyundai's American division. He says Hyundai didn't target any single company, but he says that some of Hyundai's gains came from its higher-end Asian rival.
It's clear we've taken some share from Toyota.
Hyundai doesn't emphasize it, but the rivalry with the Japanese automaker is natural and historic. After all, Japan ruled Korea during much of the first half of the 20th century. In the automotive world, Japan still holds the upper hand. Despite its losses in the U.S., Toyota still sells more than three times as many cars here as Hyundai. Frank Langfitt, NPR News, Washington.